Yes.
Are you ready?
Yes, Your Honor.
I know you are.
Oh.
My councilwoman on the line, ready?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor.
All right, we're happy to hear argument in number 20-1854, Williams versus Garland.
Thank you, Judge Motzen. May it please the court. My client was deported in 2007 based on, in part, on a statute that the Supreme Court held unconstitutional in 2018. Following year, my client filed a motion to reconsider based on this change in law. The question before the court today is whether the Board of Immigration Appeals erred either in denying my client's request for equitable tolling or in declining to reconsider its prior decision sua sponte. Unless the court prefers otherwise, I will address the equitable tolling argument first.
As a question of reconsidering, has that issue been decided by the BIA?
Pardon me, Your Honor, has which question been decided?
Decided by the BIA?
The BIA denied my client's request for equitable tolling and therefore did not reach the merits of the motion to reconsider itself.
Was there anything? So there's something hanging out there.
Yes. And if this court was to remand and find that my client exercised the diligence necessary for equitable tolling, then on remand, we would ask it to reach the merits of the motion to reconsider.
If we agree that we have jurisdiction to as to whether Williams was his properly qualified as aggravated felon, does the law of the case doctrine apply so that if we were to remand it, the BIA would be bound by our decision?
I think it's actually undisputed between the parties that my client's conviction no longer qualifies as an aggravated felony. And that issue is squarely before the board. That was raised in the motion to reconsider. Now, before getting to the merits of the equitable tolling argument, I would hope to quickly address the issues on which the parties agree and or on which the court may not need to reach. The parties agree that both the deadline and numerical limitations on motions to reconsider are subject to equitable tolling. While the parties disagree over whether my client is subject to the jurisdictional bar in 1252A2C, they agree that the court may not actually need to reach that admittedly complicated question. Because even if my client is subject to the jurisdictional bar, there is only one factual issue that this court would be unable to reach, and that is whether the attorney who filed the motion to reconsider in 2019 was acting pro bono. So if this court finds that whether that attorney was acting pro bono would not make any difference to its ultimate determination, then it does not need to reach the jurisdictional arguments. But for purposes of today's argument, I'm happy to assume that my client is subject to the jurisdictional bar and that his attorney was acting pro bono, even though the record shows she was not. Now, on the merits, the question before the court is very narrow. The board did not address whether my client satisfied the extraordinary circumstances component of the equitable tolling inquiry. The only basis for the board's decision was its belief that my client did not act with sufficient diligence in filing his motion after the Supreme Court issued its decision in DiMaia. Now, while the parties disagree over the standard of review that the court should apply to that issue, our positions may actually be closer than they appear. On page 14 of its brief, the government asked the court to review the board's decision for abuse of discretion, but, quote, with subsidiary legal conclusions reviewed de novo. And that is all we're asking. The Supreme Court held in Guerrero-Lasprilla that whether an alien acted with the requisite diligence is a legal standard. And this court has held on many occasions that an agency abuses its discretion when it errs as a matter of law. So even if abuse of discretion is nominally the correct overall standard, the court should apply de novo review to the specific legal question of whether my client acted with requisite diligence. Now, yes, Your Honor.
Don't we apply abuse of discretion review to many instances where we apply a legal standard to facts? So when we review the legal standard, it's de novo, right? Whether the BIA had the correct standard in mind. Facts we review for clear error, but often we apply abuse of discretion review when the law is applied to the facts. Think like evidentiary rulings, right, in a district court. We review those for abuse of discretion, even though it may be, in fact, a question, mixed question of law and fact. Mm-hmm. Is that, why is that not the appropriate way to think about it?
Well, I would look to this court's recent decision in Galvan, which was decided after the briefs were in, but we submitted a 28J letter on that. And that involved another mixed question that this court found for the first time it had jurisdiction to review under Galvan. And it found that because it is a mixed question, it would apply de novo review to the ultimate determination in that case of whether the alien's removal would result in exceptional and extremely unusual hardship. So that is a very similar fact-bound determination, but the court said, nonetheless, we apply de novo review. And I would also note that this court said in Rouse, its en banc decision in 2003, that it would apply de novo review to the ultimate determination of whether, the ultimate diligence determination based on settled facts. So with respect to the merits question, it's undisputed that the diligence required for equitable tolling is reasonable diligence, not maximum feasible diligence. And the problem with the board's decision in this case, in our view, is that it simply took an unreasonable view of what an alien in my client's position should have taken following his removal. Even though my client was deported in 2007, the board believed that he still should have been in touch either with his original attorney or that he should have been seeking, that he should have sought out new counsel simply to stay abreast of changes in the law. But Your Honors, the board's reasoning not only reflects a quintessential case of hindsight bias, but is simply divorced from reality. Consulting with an attorney is not like going to the dentist or getting your oil changed. It is not something people do every 6 months as a matter of course. It is something that people only do when they have a problem that they believe an attorney is actually capable of solving. So aliens like my client, who have both exhausted their appeals and been deported from the country, generally have no need to seek out the advice of an attorney. And as we say in our briefs, and the government does not dispute, upholding the board's decision would mean that aliens who have been deported from the country would need to regularly consult with an attorney in perpetuity.
I thought the diligence inquiry was they looked at from the time of the Supreme Court's decision until your client sought legal counsel.
Your Honor, we would agree that is the correct inquiry.
They looked at the longer period, I think.
Yes, and just as a practical matter, I mean, we know now that the Supreme Court issued a decision in 2018, but there's no way an alien would be able to predict.
Right. So how are they supposed to evaluate diligence? If you say there's no reason someone who's deported thinks they have a legal problem that they need an attorney for, they don't know a Supreme Court decision's coming. How on earth do you measure diligence? Say they find out about the decision 20 years after it happened. But the moment they find out, they seek an attorney. Is that diligent?
Certainly in all cases, diligence must be exercised from the moment the alien discovers the new law. Otherwise, we think it's case by case. And we think as a general rule, aliens who have been deported cannot be expected to seek out legal advice.
Your rule would be from the moment they discover. And they don't have to be diligent in looking for it. They just stumble upon it.
I believe as a general matter, they do not have to be diligent in investigating. No, they only have to be diligent once they discover. Now,
happen to find out about it.
Yes, but I think there are exceptions. And I think this court's decision in Lawrence provides a helpful counterexample. So in that case, Mr. Lawrence's case, while his case was pending at the BIA, the Supreme Court actually heard oral argument in the decision that was relevant to his case. And then the Supreme Court issued its decision, that was the Moncrief decision, just a few months after he was deported. So we think in that case, it was plainly reasonable for the board and this court to expect Mr. Lawrence to stay abreast of the law even after he was deported. But in this case, by contrast, there was no reason for my client to expect that the Supreme Court might one day issue not one, but two decisions that would fortuitously and in combination undermine the board's finding that his conviction qualified as an aggravated felony. And of course,
go back to the time when they issued it. So where do we start when we look to determine whether he was diligent or not? What time?
Sure. We think in this case that you look at the time that my client learned that he actually had a basis to file a motion with the board. So he did not know that for certain until his new attorney received the results from a FOIA request in June of 2019, where she received his entire immigration record. There's no version of PACER. In the immigration administrative system, you have to file a FOIA request. And as soon as she got it, she realized, aha, there is a basis to file a motion to reconsider with the board. And exactly 30 days later, that motion to reconsider was filed.
Well, do you have a fallback position?
A fallback position on equitable tolling?
On the, when the period for equitable tolling would begin. For example, I thought that perhaps you were arguing that the date when Sessions came out was versus DiMaio was 2018 and Johnson was 2010. And so that you needed both. So you would start with the 2018 date and you filed in 2019.
Yes.
Well, about, I don't know, 8 months.
Sure. But I think the ultimate question is what is reasonable to expect of an alien in my client's position? And given all these circumstances in this case, we don't think it would have been reasonable to expect my client to have been actively seeking legal advice at the time that DiMaio came out in 2018. I would agree that that's kind of the starting point because that's the point.
That's a lot closer than the agency did, correct?
Oh, certainly. Right. Yeah, yes. The agency was expecting him to be consulting with an attorney practically from the moment he returned to Jamaica. And we think that's certainly not correct.
I thought it was pretty clear the agency accepted your representation that the relevant time period was between DiMaio in April of 2018 and then in whenever it was June or whatever of 2019 when you filed.
Well, I think the board has some language going both ways, but we think the correct starting point is when DiMaio was issued. But we think when DiMaio was issued, it was not reasonable to expect my client to be seeking legal advice. We think it's only reasonable to expect him to do anything once he learned that there was something that he could even potentially file, by which point was June 2019, and then he did file within 30 days after that. Now, if the court has any concerns that ruling from my client would open the floodgates to all sorts of equitable tolling claims, I think that concern is unfounded for a number of reasons. First, equitable tolling requires, of course, both a showing of reasonable diligence and extraordinary circumstances. And between those two requirements, we think extraordinary circumstances is the more logical and effective gatekeeper, especially in cases involving changes in law. Now, we think we could satisfy the extraordinary circumstances requirement in this case.
But that's still up for grabs.
Yes, the board never reached that. But given how unusual it is for Congress to pass unconstitutional statutes, we think we could satisfy that. But second, even when aliens do satisfy the equitable tolling requirements, they also have to satisfy the separate requirements for a motion to reopen and a motion to reconsider, both of which can be denied in the exercise of discretion. Now, again, we think we would have a strong argument on that front, because there's no dispute that my client's conviction is not an aggravated felony. And the immigration judge originally found that he did merit a favorable exercise of discretion in connection with his cancellation application. And just finally, to the extent that the court might believe that ruling for my client would simply, I'm out of time.
You can finish.
Yes. Would simply allow too many wrongfully deported aliens to return to the United States. I mean, we would think that is not a valid concern because if an alien should not have been deported in the first place, we think it would not be the role of the courts to deny his claim simply because it might lead to the granting of claims of similarly situated aliens.
Just hold on a second.
Yes.
Thank you very much. We're happy to hear from you.
Hey, may it please the court, Lindsay Dunn on behalf of the respondent. I do want to begin by clarifying a bit of what has been discussed that's been agreed upon or that the parties agree upon. There is this issue in terms of Mr. Williams being charged as deportable in terms of the aggravated felony charge, but he also was found deportable based upon a conviction involving moral turpitude. And the parties agree that that was never, that any challenge to that has never been exhausted before the board. So in other words, the IJ found that it was never brought up in the counseled motion for affirmance that was filed Initially, it was never brought up in the motion to reopen that was counseled. It wasn't brought up in the subsequent petition for review that petitioner did file pro se before this court. And it also was not brought up in the last motion to reopen that we're discussing today. So there is that outlying ground of removability that simply has not been exhausted before the agency.
You agree with counsel's representation that his crime no longer qualifies under the
In terms of the aggravated felony, which is which was a separate ground of removal. I do note the agency never addressed that, so it hasn't been something that the government has contested.
So the government agrees. It doesn't contest.
I'm not trying to make it any more difficult for the court than necessary, but I will concede that it was not the ground that this motion to reconsider was denied on. Okay. It just wasn't reached.
Well, if we send the case back, what's your position going to be about the aggravated felon issue?
That would be a position that the DHS would have to come up with.
Which you follow Supreme Court law?
Absolutely. So, Your Honors, turning quickly to the issue in terms of how the court is going to review or what the standard of review should be in this case. I do want to note that the parties, as opposing counsel mentioned, the parties agree that Guerrero left open this question as to what the standard of review would be. But the government does note that Galvin, which opposing counsel raised, reviews a hardship determination for purposes of cancellation of removal. And that was previously unreviewable as discretionary. This is different in this case because, as this court has done in Lawrence, abuse of discretion has been the standard that's been applied in these types of cases. So Lawrence is a good example here because, for another reason, the court first looked de novo, can we look at the diligence inquiry, but then was clear when it got to the merits of the diligence inquiry, applied abuse of discretion. And that's consistent with also what the Fifth Circuit did when Guerrero was sent back. It applied abuse of discretion. It has since applied this abuse of discretion in this context. And also opposing counsel did in a 28J letter send in a Tenth Circuit case, Perdue v. Garland. That's 13 F 4th 1125. And we note that the Tenth Circuit too, when looking at equitable tolling, is applying abuse of discretion. So applying abuse of discretion would be not only consistent with what this court has done when it has looked at the diligence inquiry, but it's also would be consistent with the 10th and the Fifth Circuits. So just wanted to clarify that.
We do have a long line of cases that hold that the ultimate application of facts to the legal standard is a legal inquiry. My first question, and some of those cases are exceptional hardship and Galvin v. Garland, Whitaker case, government acquiescence in torture, another case, good faith marriage. We've said that is a legal inquiry. Why shouldn't that be the case here?
Again, the government notes that those are different types of inquiries, and where, as in here, this court has looked at abuse of discretion in the context of tolling, it has first determined, can we look at the question, and that becomes a legal inquiry, but then it is reverted back to abuse of discretion. We're simply asking the court to be consistent with what it has done. And again, I specifically point to Lawrence. That's exactly what happened there. And so we're asking the court to again be consistent. With respect to then looking at this in terms of the merits. And again, although the government is arguing that the standard should be abuse of discretion, whether it's abuse of discretion or de novo, the government argues that here, the petitioner, Mr. Williams, simply just did not show that he acted as a reasonable person should in this circumstance. I do want to point the court to the bottom of page 4 through the top of page 5 in the record, because here the agency makes clear that it is looking at that period after Demai is issued. The agency says that petitioner claims that only after the Supreme Court's holding in Amaya would such a motion demonstrate an error of law that would support reconsideration of the board's decision. Assuming this analysis is correct, the circumstances presented by the respondent do not show that he pursued his motion with due diligence after the Supreme Court's holding in Sessions v. Demai. That's sort of at the beginning of the agency's analysis, and then the analysis goes from there. There are points within the agency's decision when it does refer generally to the whole period, but it's very clear when one reads this closely that the agency is assuming that the period is starting at Demai in 2018 and saying, essentially, you didn't show any diligence or you didn't show the requisite diligence that we're requiring here. And so, again, I wanted to clarify the time period because that's relevant for the merits of the equitable tolling, but also the argument that petitioner is making with respect to sua sponte. So again, the time period, if it starts at Demai, the agency is saying here that consistent with what is in the declarations and what petitioner's counsel argued in the motion, petitioner just simply didn't show the requisite diligence in that period. Petitioner represented that he had been with his significant other since 2007. She came to Jamaica. They married in January of 2019. 3 months after that, she sought counsel to see if there was a possibility if her husband could return. And then only after that do we see petitioner making any efforts with respect to his claim. And really what the board is saying here is, in the past, you've had pro bono counsel. You've not made, or you've not in any way shown that that there was any diligence that was, the court, the argument here is that no diligence was shown during this period. Nothing can be pointed to. It's different than a situation like Lawrence, where Lawrence is arguing that from the moment he set foot in Jamaica, or the entirety of that period, he was at least trying to contact counsel, trying to do something. Here, if one looks specifically at the motion itself, at the declarations, there's just nothing that's been represented that was done in that full year period after Demai was issued, and the board determined that simply wasn't reasonable.
What if you had the same facts, but in fact his with this exception, in other words, there hasn't been a daily a look at SCOTUS blog or anything else, so we don't have a day by day consideration by the claimant, but the claimant is significant other goes to a lawyer 2 months after and they find it. Would that be adequate?
Again, it's case by case, but the court didn't just look at timeliness.
Sort of, I don't understand. So that you have to know the moment it comes out. There must be some time that it is part of the limitation.
I don't think that the board is saying that you have to know the moment that it came out. The board is making the argument that in this entire period, the record is silent to any sort of diligence being shown.
I understand.
I'm sorry if the delay is. Let me pause.
All I'm asking you is if the delay was 2 months and there was no efforts during that 2 months, would that down the case too?
I think that puts you one in a different circumstance in terms of the timing, yes. But really, again, the board is looking at, there's an entire year where nothing is done. So it's not only that it's not discovered, it's that nothing is done. And this person has had pro bono counsel in the past and has shown that his wife has the ability to contact counsel on his behalf in the United States where she lives. Nevertheless, there's this entire year where nothing is done.
I understand that there's, I think it's 9 months, but we'll go with your entire year right now. What I'm asking you is, what if just 2 months, same facts otherwise, he doesn't do anything for 2 months, but then he files?
Your Honor, I would view that differently. I do think that's a different, you know, we're giving a different time frame here. I don't think, again, that the board is saying that he had to do something the moment that the case came out. It's that he didn't show reasonable diligence by doing nothing for that extended period after.
And what I'm trying to do is to piece out from that what somebody in the future could conclude would be reasonable diligence. And you won't seem to answer, so I suggested, would 2 months be reasonable diligence?
I would think so, if some sort of diligence were shown.
In 2 months?
Yes.
Okay.
But again, unfortunately, that simply just was not the case here. I do want to also address counsel's argument in briefing that the court should find jurisdiction to look at this in terms of the sua sponte denial. And again, just point the court to the actual decision in the record. Here, counsel's arguing that the court should upend its previous precedent and look at the sua sponte denial based on error. And no error has been shown here with respect to the agency decision. Counsel's basing this on 2 points. One, the citation of matter of GLC for the proposition that it may consider non-citizen's diligence in deciding whether to sua sponte reopen. The government, again, reasserts that this was an accurate discussion of what happened in matter of GLC. And also, the government makes this critical note that, unlike in cases in other jurisdictions where the court has decided to pierce this and look at the sua sponte denial, here, there's no material error here that would change the decision. And I'll look at a case like Mahmoud v. Holder in the Second Circuit, where the court basically declined to exercise sua sponte authority based on its understanding that there the petitioner would automatically be barred from seeking adjustment. Here, there's nothing like that. Our petitioner doesn't point to anything in that regard. There's nothing that petitioner can point to that suggests that the agency can't look at diligence when it's examining sua sponte, as it did here. And it's consistent with what the agency has done in other cases. There's simply just nothing prohibiting the board from doing what it did, whether it were to cite that case or not. And the second note, petitioner again is arguing that with respect to the sua sponte assessment, that the court is looking at the time frame of, you know, beginning when petitioner was removed to Jamaica until the time that he filed, And I do point the court to the language of the language in the record at AR5. The board specifically says that it's referring to its discussion above. I'm in that last paragraph. The court says, as discussed above, the respondent has not satisfactorily explained his lack of diligence. The court discusses the court refers to the 12-year period, but the entire analysis is framed above, and the analysis that the board is referred to by that period after DiMaia. So there's no error there. And petitioner really there's no reason why the court would stray from what it has done in the past in terms of not looking at the sua sponte denial. And again, that's also consistent with what the court has said in Lawrence. And I point the court to footnote 5 in Lawrence, where the court here again explains that where there's no perceived legal error, this is just not something the court is going to do.
Ms. Dunn, let me ask you this. After he found out about DiMaia, was he diligent?
The record does show that steps were taken to file something, but again that's months and months after DiMaia has been decided, where in that period before nothing was done.
Well,
and that's what the board's looking at here.
That he was diligent after he found out about DiMaia, shouldn't that weigh in our analysis?
Not in terms of how the court has looked at this in the past. And I will note that while the court has, in this case, looked at that the entire period after DiMaia, in Lawrence, the court has said that it's up to the petitioner to show diligence during the entire period. And that includes diligence in discovering that there is a change in law. And I'll point the court there to Lawrence at 826 F3rd at 204 through 205. And there the court is upholding a decision, and the board had in that decision cited Rashid v. Mukoski at 533 F3rd 127. That's a Second Circuit case, but explains that again, it's the petitioner has to show some sort of effort, even if the discovery isn't made, the petitioner has to show that there was some diligence in trying to make the discovery. Here, as in that case, there's just nothing that showed during that period. And the board was correct in determining that simply is not reasonable.
Don't think we have any more questions.
Thank you very much. Again, the government reasserts all of the arguments made in its briefing, and thanks the court.
Thank you very much. Do we have any rebuttal?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. If I could just tie up a few loose ends on equitable tolling before moving to the sua sponte argument. Just to clarify.
Tell me what the difference is between the two, because the reason why you think that the sua sponte should have been granted is because wasn't there a legal error? And the legal error, it goes back to the equitable tolling, doesn't it? So aren't they sort of two sides of the same coin?
They're similar but distinct. The equitable tolling argument simply, if equitable tolling is granted, then the board would be applying just the regular baseline standard for a motion to reconsider, which is whether there has been a change in law. To prevail on a sua sponte motion, you have to show that the change in law was fundamental. So there is a different standard that the board applies. Just to clarify the relationship history between my client and his now wife, they actually first got together in 1997, and they did have children together in 1999 and 2002. But in the following decade, my client had two children with another woman. She had two children with another man. She did eventually visit him in Jamaica after he was deported, but they did not officially marry until January of 19. January of 2019, which is why she went to see an immigration attorney in April of 2019. So the point is simply that while the board didn't say anything that was literally false in its decision kind of misleadingly suggests that my client and his wife have been married for decades, which simply is not the case. Now, on the merits, there was some discussion about, you know, would 2 months be an appropriate limit?
Before we get to that, can I ask you about the standard of review?
Yeah.
The government points us to Lawrence, which I think is correct. Lawrence applied abuse of discretion. And so I think the question for us is, does Guerrero require us to overrule our precedent? Is it on point and clear enough that we can overrule Lawrence? Or what's your position on that relationship?
Well, that's a question I've grappled with. But I think Lawrence actually, I think any discussion of abuse of discretion was dicta, because there was only one narrow question before the court in Lawrence was whether the board even applied the correct standard. Because at that time, this court regarded the due diligence determination as a factual inquiry that it did not even have jurisdiction to reach.
How can the standard of review be dicta? It's the lens through which the court is reviewing the claim. Even if you think, well, ultimately they would have won or lost under a different standard, the court says we're applying a certain standard. How can that be dicta?
Well, my point is the court did not have jurisdiction to actually reach the merits of the equitable tolling claim in Lawrence, because Lawrence was decided before Guerrero-Lasprilla. I think there's frankly conflicting case law on what standard should be applied to equitable tolling, because there are many other cases, including Rouse, that have applied de novo to the ultimate diligence determination.
But we have case law applying abuse of discretion to equitable tolling before the BIA, exactly this context. And so you have the burden to show that we need to change our precedent, and not just that we need to, but as a panel of three, that we're even allowed to. And the only way you can do that is by pointing to something the Supreme Court or Congress has done that requires us to overrule what a previous panel has done. Otherwise, we have to sit en banc. So what requires us to change that?
We think Guerrero-Lasprilla would be sufficiently clear, because before Guerrero-Lasprilla,
but it didn't talk. They specifically reserved the question of what standard of review replies, which indicates there could be multiple different ones that might be appropriate.
That's true. But in Galvan, this court found, because of Guerrero-Lasprilla, not only that it had jurisdiction,
right,
but that it would apply de novo review to the ultimate question.
That's right. But that's in a situation where we didn't have any precedent about what standard of review applied, because we had previously refused to consider those questions.
At the end of the day, Your Honor, we think we win even under abuse of discretion, because it's clear that when an agency errs as a matter of law, that is an abuse of discretion.
Sure. Thank you.
Okay. So just on the question of, you know, if there is a rule, 2 months, what is it? Our point is that the only way that an alien could guarantee that an alien would act within 2 months, pardon me, is if they are having consultations with an attorney on a regular basis. That's the only way to guarantee that. So if the court finds that my client did not act with sufficient diligence, immigration lawyers will have to advise their clients going forward, even after they're deported, that they need to schedule regular consultations with them. So we would ask the court, if it denies our claim on the merits, to at least provide some guidance to the immigration bar as to how frequent is enough. Does it have to be once a year? Does it need to be every 6 months? Does it need to be once per month? Because the immigration bar will need to provide guidance to their clients in the event that they're deported, should they ever want to try to file a motion based on a change in law.
Can diligence take other forms? I know here we're talking about checking in with the attorney, because that's what he did. That's the diligence that he presented to the BIA, was my wife checked with an attorney. Mm-hmm. But presumably diligence can take other forms, right? He could have, you know, I don't know what your particular client could have done, but at any future case, there could be someone who says, I don't know, I checked the newspaper, or I looked here, I looked there, places that may or may not have the answer, right? The question is not whether they would have found it, but whether they were diligent in trying, right? So I take your point, but I'm not sure we have to set out a framework for immigration attorneys, because diligence is as vast and broad as there are different kinds of cases.
Sure. I think in the context of a change in law, or where the Supreme Court is overruling decision is unconstitutional, it's hard to imagine a circumstance where a lay person would be able to piece that all together without talking to attorney. Although if a deported person was previously a paralegal, they might be able to do that. But I think in general, that would be difficult for them to do. in my time left, just briefly on the reviewability of the sua sponte question, we would ask it to join the seven other circuits that have held that they are able to reach asserted legal errors made in connection with the denial of a sua sponte motion. And we think the reason is very straightforward. The Supreme Court has held that there is a strong presumption favoring judicial review of administrative action, and that the exception in section 701A2 only applies when there is no judicially manageable standard. So it follows that when the board alleges that the board has committed legal error in denying a sua sponte motion, there is a judicially manageable standard that courts can apply.
That doesn't help you, does it? Because all the other courts that you cite, they've done this when the court, the BIA, thought it lacked the power or it had some sort of misperception about the legal background. It was something pretty fundamental. It was not, you know, we think that it reached the wrong decision about equitable tolling. No one has reviewed that de novo.
I'm talking about simply an asserted legal error, a question of law. And as I read those cases, those courts have held that they can review questions of law raised in challenging a sua sponte motion, just as they can review questions of law raised in challenging in a petition for you. For petition for review on direct appeal. Many, if not most courts that have addressed this issue in our favor have made an analogy to section 1252A2D of the INA. That's provision that authorizes courts to review questions of law. And we think that would be that would be the most administrable line if the court agrees with our position to say, just as we can review questions of law and constitutional claims on a regular petition for review, so can we review constitutional claims and questions of law raised in connection with the denial of a sua sponte motion. The court has no, yes.
So, excuse me, just so I understand, in response to my colleague's question, you concede that none of those out-of-circuit cases that you cite deal with the question of law that we have here, but they all deal with questions of law, which you think this is. Is that right?
Correct.
Further questions? No. Thank you very much. We appreciate the argument from both counsel, and we're sorry that we're not able to come down and shake hands. We can do it remotely. And we hope the next time you're here, we will be able to do so. So I ask the clerk to adjourn court.
This honorable court stands adjourned until this afternoon at 2 p.m. God save the United States and this honorable court.